Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
Hello, this is Ilona Thompson with Palate Exposure. I'm here with Anne Favia Erickson, and we're here in the most zen spot I think I've ever been to. Was surrounded by this serenity and beauty and peace and gorgeous gardens. So we're gonna start from that place. I obviously wanna find out what Annie's background is so you guys can learn everything about her. But since we started with a tour that's very, very special through the gardens, I just want you to talk a little bit about that. How did that property come about?
Sure. This property has actually been one. So we're in Coombsville, Napa Valley right now, which is the southeastern corner of the Napa Valley, on this all the way on the southern end of the Vaca Mountain Range. And we love the Vaca Mountain Range because this is where all the volcanic soils are. And when you grow grapes, one of the greatest things about being in the Napa Valley is finding these wonderful volcanic soils. And the east side of the valley, this Vaca Range, is comprised of predominantly volcanic soils. So this has been a range that we've been familiarizing ourselves with for many years, both Andy and I, making wine and doing viticulture kind of up and down this eastern range. We also have worked on the Western Range, but the Mayacamas Range, but less so. And we just are kind of drawn over here to the east side. And we saw this property many years ago, but it was out of our range. And Andy and I both fell in love with it because I grew up in Connecticut, and there are a lot of old homes there and old properties. Our house was actually a cow barn in the 1800s that was renovated that I grew up in. In the 1970s, and I just am attracted to kind of older things. Napa Valley doesn't have very many old properties left, so when I saw this place, I just had a spot in my heart that leapt, you know? Yeah. But it was actually, a friend of ours bought it, and it ended up not being the right property for what he wanted to do, so many years later, we convinced him to sell to us. So we bought the property in 2014 and moved in just a few days before the 2014 earthquake.
Wow.
And that was a little scary. And we realized that we needed to do a much bigger structural retrofit than we had originally set out for. And we set out to do just that right after it. So the home and winery were built in 1886. And we spent the last 4 years kind of disassembling and then reassembling the main house and winery. So the winery is downstairs. It's an old stone cellar. And the walls are about 2 foot thick. And the house was just kind of sitting on that. So we made the structural retrofit to do lots of piers. We did about 15 to 20 piers that go down 15 to 20 feet, and then tied all that in with rebar and tied it into the existing kind of steel structure that is holding it together now. And then the house was actually built before electricity and plumbing, so they added that probably in the 20s and 30s, and when they did a real wonky job of it. So we gutted the whole upstairs and took it down to studs. We numbered every piece of wainscoting, every piece of molding, and door and hinge and window and everything, and put those all in construction trailers numbered by the room, and then fixed everything on the inside and put it all back. So it looks quite historical there now, but it's absolutely updated, so that's great. It was a really interesting process, and we've renovated, Andy and I have renovated. This is our fourth property to renovate together, but this one was definitely the most significant, so it was fun.
Sounds like a labor of love and a huge undertaking.
Absolutely.
And serendipity, how it wound up in your hands after all.
Yeah.
Is it possible to visit for folks, or is it open at all?
Yeah, so since we live literally above the winery, as I mentioned, so we keep our weekends kind of just for family time. So, but we are open Monday through Friday at 10 and 2 for tasting by appointment. And it's really fun to see it because we're trying to not only we have renovated not only the structures, but also the gardens. Originally, this was Antonio Carboni Winery and Italian Gardens. When Antonio settled in the 1870s, wine was one part of the culture, but definitely food was the it is now a big part of the culture. And so he had, we have really interesting old records that show what he was selling to restaurants in San Francisco, peppers and eggplants and, you know, by the bushel and grapes by the carload. And so we wanted to kind of revive that part of the property too. So we grow quite a few, we grow a lot of vegetables for quite a few restaurants in Napa. And also I started an herbal tea company here on the property. So I grow herbs for that and dry them here on the property. And that's called Erda tea. So that's been a really fun project too that's come out of this property.
I'm actually about to have a cup of lemon verbena Erda tea and I can't wait. And you guys, this property is absolutely majestic. The moment you walk onto it, you just feel like you're in a different world. So if you have an opportunity when you're visiting Napa, please contact Fabio. Do yourself a favor. You will absolutely feel like a renewed soul once you visit. So you mentioned Connecticut. That's where you're from. You're family of six, big family, right? Six children, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
Were you?
I'm the youngest, of six.
Okay.
Yes. And my mom was an avid gardener. And my dad grew up in Manhattan, and he kind of always wanted to get out of the city. So he raised us on this property kind of off the grid to some degree. On the grid, but they grew kind of all of our food, and all my siblings did 4-H, and we would always have a fresh animal, you know, in the freezer to eat, and chickens and all that kind of thing. So it was a really, really fun way to grow up, being the youngest of a pack of kids. My mom really spent a lot of time with me. And I don't think I realized that I was really, you know, she was always outside and always in the garden because that was her true passion. And I don't think I realized that until my 20s that was my passion too. So, but I guess I learned a lot from her because it's kind of come naturally, which has been really fun to discover. And Andy, my husband, Andy Erickson, grew up in Indiana. And he was kind of surrounded by farmland, and then he ended up moving to Boston and going to school in Boston and then moving out to California too. And it was funny because we have very similar backgrounds in that we both studied other things before we came to wine, but ended up in the Napa Valley in the early 90s and then met each other in 95 here and started making wine in our garage together. And you know, have been doing that ever since in 95. And then we started Favia in 2001. And we wanted to concentrate on Cabernet Franc because we had both fallen in love with Cabernet Franc kind of independently. And then when we met, that was something that really united us. So that was fun. And we looked all over the valley for great Cabernet Franc properties. Didn't really realize that we were going to make Cabernet Sauvignon, but we had some great cab that we were blending in small percentage and had a couple barrels in 2005 that we really loved and showed to some friends, and they said, you know what, you really shouldn't blend this, you should just make some cab too. So we started making Cabernet.
Wow.
So never say never, but it's fun how I feel like our lives both have been I don't know. I mean, I guess I would say that, you know, life has all these series of forks in the road, and You can go one way or you go the other way. And I feel like our paths have both been really intuitive. And, you know, just decisions have seemed relatively easy when you're kind of have your heart open and your third eye open a little bit. I think it's easy to make decisions. So we both kind of have followed this path and how things have been, you know, working really well since doing that, I feel like.
It sounds very serendipitous again, you know, you coming from similar backgrounds and uniting in Napa Valley over the love of wine. Your brand is certainly very well received by both trade and press, and what I've read over the years and what I tasted conversely is that it's very authentic, very genuine. That theme repeats itself through all the reviews and comments about your wine, and clearly the remarks that you've made point in that direction because it comes from the heart, it comes from the intuition. You know, it's very pure, it's very intentional, all the things that we like about wine.
Yeah, well, you know, we have the technical background. I went back and studied viticulture after my French literature and art history degree. Andy studied political science and Latin American politics. And then he went back to school and had his master's in enology. So we definitely have the science and use the science. But there's a lot of it that is really trusting nature. You know, I mean, I would say that our winemaking is really based in the vineyard all year long, and number one, picking a great site. That's the absolutely the most important decision that you can do when you're making wine. Luckily in Napa Valley, there are a lot of great sites. We've chosen mostly sites, as I mentioned, on the east side of the valley in the Vaca Range, mostly up in the hills, actually all up in the hills. And from looking at different vineyards over the years, I really love eastern exposures and northern exposures on the east side. Mm-hmm. That aspect can allow you to have the great volcanic soils, but less of that intense afternoon light and mm-hmm. and more of that really soft, beautiful morning light. And I feel like those little things that we have kind of identified over the years, and then the viticulture just being out there. You know, we're out in the vineyards all the time. Not only me as viticulturist, but Andy as winemaker. We're our whole team is out in the vineyard from pruning until harvest time, and then beyond. You know, we spend a lot of time, and we have great crews, and work with really incredible growers that are really collaborative. And direct that farming to a point where we feel really confident that we're achieving a lot of balance in the vineyard, so that we don't have to wrestle with the grapes when they're in the winery. We're really, you know, making all the important decisions during the growing season so that the winemaking can be really straightforward, classic winemaking, and really natural winemaking. I mean, we really don't add anything to the wines once they're in the winery. It's just, you know, kind of a long cold soak, and then we warm up the tank and get those native yeasts going. And then Andy loves both a cold soak in the front end, that extraction in the front end, and a kind of a long maceration on the back end. So usually mm-hmm. our grapes are on the skins for, you know, 30 days. And then we'll press off, go to barrel for malolactic, and very little racking, just a couple times usually over the life of a wine. So really simple, but with great raw materials, it kind of just happens, you know, well, that's not true. We're watching it. So I'm looking at a microscope right now. We're we're looking at the fermentations really closely. We're always monitoring, so we can always, you know, intervene if we absolutely had to. But yeah. Generally, you know, it's pretty straightforward, which is great.
So I'm picturing this in my mind. You grew up surrounded by natural beauty because your dad wanted to facilitate that. Your mom, that clearly sounds like a great horticultural talent, which now I understand your green thumb. And then degree in French literature. At what point did this transition into the thinking on wine? What happened?
Well, you know, I lived in France for a few times. I went a lot during college. I was in France for about 18 months during the 4 years of college, and then again another summer. So almost half of college I spent in France, and there that culture of wine is just so, you know, it's just so part of the fabric.
It permeates everything.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So I just got more and more into wine. My dad had made wine when we were growing up. Mm-hmm. A lot, you know, he would get boxes of grapes shipped out from California to Connecticut, and he and his Italian buddies, Andy Proto and his other friends, would be there and, you know, crush the grapes and do these small fermentations and carboys and, you know, whatever else they could ferment in. And so we always had home wine at our house, part of wine, part of dinner, and enjoying, you know, the family meal. We all ate together most nights, and always on Sunday you had to be home for dinner. And we kind of have that same culture and and ritual with our family here. We have a lot of extended family here, so Sundays mm-hmm. are, if people are in town, we get together a lot most Sundays and cook a big meal together and enjoy that. So just always loved that part of it. And I didn't realize, you know, I didn't realize I loved science. You know, I was always into the arts. I was a classical ballet dancer as a kid, and wow. studied literature, and I love the humanities, so I always thought that's what I was good at, and I thought that maybe I wasn't good at the other things. And then when I started working my first job at Newton Vineyard in 1993, and John Konsgaard was the winemaker. I don't know if you, have you ever interviewed John?
Not formally, but I've had conversations with him, and it seems like he's been a mentor to some of the top winemakers, viticulturalists. It seems like he touched a lot of lives in a profound way.
Yeah, that's absolutely true for me and Andy, actually. We both worked at Newton, me in 93 and he in 94. And John is just he's a Renaissance man. I mean, he is able to kind of do it all and do it all well. And he just has a great passion for really digging in and learning something really deep, in a deep, very deep way. And I loved, you know, that was my first job working in the office, so I wasn't hired to do anything technical, but he was the winemaker, so I did, you know, office work and helped translate for tours and things like that. But I really loved what he was doing, so I said, John, you know, this obviously isn't the job for me. Do you think you could get me an internship? And I wanted to work for a woman just because it was something that was really important to me, that I learned how to model, you know, working as a woman, a strong woman in the industry. So he actually introduced me to Kathy Corison, and I worked for Kathy for 2 years in her cellar. And she was such an amazing role model also for me, because she just, you know, she just figures out when she started, you know, she went to Davis in the 70s with all these guys, and with that class where John Konsgaard and Lee Hudson and Bill Dyer and Donnie Dyer and, you know, a bunch of other people were kind of at Davis at that time. And they realized, these women that were initially in the wine business, you know, they realized they needed to figure out a way to do everything that the guys were doing without brawn. So how do you use your brains to do these things? How do you use your will to do these things? And Kathy was such an amazing mentor, because that was kind of just part of her ethos and also part of what she taught me. So so that was great luck to be introduced to her. And she bought the Kronos Vineyard, and we went out to, you know, mess around and prune one day, and that's where the skies parted for me. I realized that I really wanted to be in the vineyard. So I went back to school and studied viticulture, and then wanted to work for a vineyard manager. And she had some amazing Cabernet Franc in her cellar that she purchased from David Abreu, who I didn't know. I didn't know who any of these people were. I mean, it wasn't like I was looking for the who's who of the Napa Valley. They just all kind of fell in my lap. I had no idea. And I was lucky enough to meet David one day on the crush pad and tell him, you know, I love these grapes that you just delivered. The wine in the cellar is my favorite Cabernet Franc there, and I just love this wine. I'd love to come see the vineyard someday. I'm graduating soon. I'd love to work for you if you ever have any openings. And he and I hit it off, and we ended up working together for over a decade. I did viticulture for him and project management during that period of late 90s and through the 2000s, when a lot of the vineyards were being replanted in the Napa Valley. Many of those vineyards had been planted to AXR rootstock and had phylloxera, so they all needed to be replanted. And also new projects that were being developed kind of up in the hills. So it was fun. We saw a lot of the valley from literally underground up. And that was so exciting for me. I love doing vineyard redevelopment. I think it's, and new development. I just think, you know, that whole architecture of building a great vineyard, choosing a great site, and choosing the right rootstock, and choosing the right trellis system, and spacing, and aspect, and row direction, and, you know, all the things that you do to build that architecture of a world-class vineyard seems very, just fun to me. So that's really what I dug in on and learned a lot. And that kind of helped me figure out what areas in the valley Andy and I wanted to make our wines from, what vineyards showed the characters that we really wanted to see. That was a really long answer, sorry.
No, it's a great answer, and there's a lot to unpack within that answer. In the 90s, a lot of cult wineries started appearing on the horizon, and they took the world by storm. And I suspect you worked and designed a lot of vineyards that those wineries owned.
Yeah, that was definitely a time of a lot of, like I said, a lot of redevelopment and new development. And when California and Napa in particular just came on the map of being able to make wines of pedigree and mm-hmm. wines that could stand next to, you know, the best wines in the world. And I think that's just a testament to this beautiful valley and how it's just really suited for grapes.
Well, in my memory, it was rather fast and furious. You know, it was just such an intense, almost an onslaught of extraordinary producers that were, you know, getting high scores almost immediately from the first vintage. And, you know, everybody was asking who's responsible for that. And of course, winemakers got a lot of credit that they deserved, but there's also that viticultural piece that is not get talked about often, but that is what made it possible.
Yeah, I think there are, you know, I know, you know, you mentioned Mike Wolf and definitely working with David and many other, great viticulturists in the valley. And I think, the thing about planting a vineyard and seeing its potential, it takes a while for people to see it. A viticulturist can see it, but it takes years. I mean, if you identify a great site in year one, and then you do all your, you know, you get all your entitlements and you do all your work to plan the vineyard, that takes a good another year, and then you plant the vineyard. So you usually plant rootstock year one, and then you graft that in the spring of the next year. And then you have a couple more years of training that vine. So you're not even getting grapes until the third leaf, mm-hmm. And there you get just a little bit of grapes because you don't want to, you know, any great viticulturist isn't going to put a lot of fruit on those first years. You want to grow that root system for 5 to 10 years and really always have your brain underground for those first mm-hmm. first 5 to 10 years at a minimum. But underground should be at the front of mind for any great viticulturist for the life of the vineyard, because you really, you know, that's where the magic happens. So it's hard to, you know, it's a long process.
Yeah.
So then if you think, you know, that first fruit, and then 5 years later, 5 years of fruit, the vines are producing probably their capacity, their full capacity. That being said, that mid palate starts filling in. You get a great wine that first year, but then again, there's a little slump that second, third, fourth, fifth year usually. In the fifth year, that mid palate of young grape starts filling in, and then year 10, you get another great qualitative jump, and then, you know, every decade you get better and better wine. So it takes a while. It's a patient process. So maybe viticulturists get the, you know, I don't know, maybe it just takes longer for the recognition. I don't think viticulturists really are in it for that. Like,
yeah,
I was certainly never in it for a process that takes 10 years to get recognition. I think it's more just, you just really love what you're doing and you're out there every day getting dirty and looking at these great properties. But there are certainly amazing viticulturists in Napa that deserve a lot of, Phil Katuri being one of them. He's another one that we work a lot with, and I love Phil because he's as committed to organic farming as I am. As I mentioned, you know, having your mind under the soil, building those soils and farming the soils is, for me, the most important thing. So, you know, how do we build the soil with cover crops and really increase that microbial activity so that the plant can thrive? So that's something that happens much more with organic farming, and Phil can do both. I mean, he's a great viticulturist, but he also can really understands organic farming, which is a great benefit.
I was fascinated by a multitude of remarks that you made, and I want to start with a really important part of vineyard architecture, which is a sustainable mindset. When you're building a vineyard that will last potentially decades or even hundreds of years, that's not how the planting occurred in the past. It was more maybe crop load orientated, or maybe haphazard in many ways. But what you were doing, the work that you were doing, particularly in the 90s, I think was very mindful, wasn't it?
Well, sure. I mean, as land prices go up in any of these attractive appellations around the world, people want a longer-term vineyard, of course, because that initial investment, both with financial investment and mm-hmm. time investment, is pretty significant. So you absolutely need to think long-term. Mm-hmm. I was lucky enough to work on the Mayacamas property a few years ago, and we took out vines that were planted in 1951 or 52, I can't remember right now, but in the 50s. And they, you know, they were making beautiful wines. Sadly, they had, you know, their crop load had diminished to very small amounts. So they were producing levels that were not economically sustainable anymore, and that vineyard needed to be replanted. But, you know, you can look around and see 100-year-old vineyards making great wines all over the world. It absolutely can be done. So we do think long-term, for sure. A few things over the history have kind of put a wrench into that. Obviously, AXR rootstock and phylloxera, mm-hmm. but also, you know, we had a big planting boom in the 90s, and a lot of plant material was being demanded from these nurseries. And, you know, they were just really short on great plant material, so they were growing mm-hmm. it as fast as they could. So people put in vineyards that probably, with, you know, you spend all this investment, you need a great plant to put in the ground. Mm-hmm. So I think some of those vineyards went out pretty quickly just because they didn't have great plant material. But I think always the idea is to have, you know, longevity in the vineyard, for sure. I don't know any person who owns a property in any great spot that doesn't want that.
And also the sustainability, which you mentioned, that you want generationally people to be able to still source. And, you know, a lot of people think of sustainability on the production side, but not necessarily when you're actually putting the vines on the ground, and that's really important. You mentioned also that you like the East exposure, and that's where a lot of your experience took place. So why is that? Why are those specific sites so attractive?
So the east side of the valley to me just seems, I don't know, it just seems more familiar. It just seems like home. I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know how to articulate why. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Why does somebody love looking at a rose and somebody else loves looking at a peony, or I don't know. I mean, Why do you like bubbly water and I like still water? I just like the east side. I think the soils are, those rocky soils are easy for the roots to get down through and find water. You can control the vigor with the rootstock more. And I, you know, many reasons. I just like, I don't know, I just like the soils. That's probably a terrible answer.
No, it's not. It's what you like.
But that being said, as I mentioned, I like the east side soils, but I like the eastern exposures and northern exposures. Mm-hmm. So that means that they're not facing west. So why I like that is I like wines that are a little bit more restrained. We don't add acid to the wines. So we really just want to have the grapes in the tank and be able to show the time and the place. Mm-hmm. That's a big thing for Andy and I, is showing the year and that vineyard from that year. So we don't want to be manipulating what the year has given us, if at all possible. And that's a rule that we've made, you know, with our winemaking team.
So transparency is really important to you.
And yeah. We're not making a lot of wine.
Yeah.
So we want to be able to show the beauty of the vineyard from that year. So because of that, we want to try to pick at an earlier Brix. And I think the work that we've been doing over the past, you know, 15 years to two decades has really helped us get physiological ripeness before the rapid sugar accumulation. When I started in the 90s, people were really pushing the envelope on sugar ripening. And I just don't like those wines as much, those really hot vintages. I like wines that have, you know, just more natural acidity, more freshness. It's just, Andy and I like those wines better, so we want to pick earlier. So those eastern exposures and northern exposures give a little bit of a break from that that hot afternoon sun, and they help to keep the Brix lower and keep that, those grapes from kind of blowing out.
No, that makes a ton of sense. You mentioned old vines, and there's kind of nostalgic image in your mind that pops up almost immediately when you think of an old vine. And I think there's a fair amount of confusion in particularly consumer community when there's a reference to old vines, and what does it really mean? Does it bear superior fruit that's more concentrated, that's more special? Is it worth keeping old vineyards? I mean, there's all these types of questions and discussions. You mentioned that you had an opportunity to obviously work with old vines and also had to replant it. How is that for you? What are your thoughts on that?
I think that it's great to have old vines because they do, like I said, you know, vines will fill in, grapes, the character of a grape will fill in, the flavor of a grape, that mid-palate I mentioned will fill in as the vine gets older, and the wine just can get more and more interesting. But there's always that tipping point where an old vine will just be, you know, kind of stressed out at that point. Also, you get this point where it's not economically sustainable anymore. So I have both the romantics brain and the practical brain. And I think it's smart to have both, because while old vines look beautiful, they don't always produce great wines. And usually when they stop producing great wines, they're also stopping being economically sustainable. Yeah. So it's usually a trajectory that happens, because you get those drying tannins and tougher wines when they get really old, at least for, you know, the ones that I've seen. I think it would be great to have a lot of old vineyards, because I think it's, why not? They're beautiful. They have a soul. They, you know, all the right reasons. But I understand people do have to replant.
No, obviously.
You know, you can't buy a piece of property in Napa Valley for whatever the land prices are now, you know, $500,000 an acre for a fancy property, and then not get, you know, a few tons of grapes per acre.
Absolutely. No, it's just reality, like you said. So is it possible to design a vineyard to the specifications of the wine that you have in mind? So in other words, is it possible to reverse engineer from the style and a concept that you have theoretically in your head. Let's just say that I'm a wannabe vintner and I want to have the wine that has a specific set of characteristics. And I sit down with you and I ask, can you plant a vineyard to those? Is that a possibility?
Yes and no. Well, I think, you know, if you're somebody who wants to come to the Napa Valley and you know that you love wines from, you know, the character of wines from the east side of Oakville, and you just love that power, intensity, force, you know, mm-hmm. that those wines have, absolutely, that can be achieved in that neighborhood for sure. Mm-hmm. But that being said, I don't like to say, oh, I want this vineyard to taste like this. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to let the vineyard speak. I think it would be totally presumptuous to say, yes, I can make this vineyard taste like this. That's silly. I absolutely cannot do that, I don't think anyone else. Nor would they want to. I mean, mm-hmm. I think you'd be pulling someone's leg if you said that. But certainly, there's obviously great truth and great, you know, great information that each appellation has kind of a character to it, mm-hmm. and a set of characteristics that makes it from that neighborhood, you know, taste a certain way. But I like to just think of putting together a vineyard site and making a wine by letting that site speak through. So how do I balance this vineyard as best as I can through that great planning, you know, putting that vineyard architecture in the right way so that those vines you're not going to be struggling with. You get one chance to put together a great vineyard so that you're not struggling with the vineyard, either trying to invigorate the vineyard or devigorate the vineyard for the rest of the vineyard's life.
The conclusion of this interview can be found in the next podcast, already available for your download. Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson.